dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who used to give intelligence briefings for a living in the United States Navy, indeed as the Chief of Intelligence for the 7th Fleet for a time, among other distinguished positions in the course of his Navy career, is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He has gone on to do great work in a variety of other capacities, including at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington. But he has been a huge contributor to the work of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, as well as to this program. And we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him. Captain, welcome aboard, sir. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be back with you.
A couple of things are pressing on my mind. One is that at a moment when the Chinese are engaged in intensifying incursions in the air defense zone of Taiwan, we have American carrier battle groups, not one but two of them, in the South China Sea, and one of them lost an F-35. This is presumably going to be a source of a very intense competition between the United States and the Chinese to see who might recover that aircraft, sensitive equipment and all on it. Give us your sort of reading on how things are shaping up in the region at the moment, Jim, and how the Chinese are likely to be perceiving it.
Well, Frank, the Chinese are obviously have raised the ante in terms of threatening Taiwan. And so anytime the U.S. makes any kinds of operations in the area, the Chinese press tries to portray it as the provocation. But we should remember that two carrier strike groups operating in the South China Sea, while isn't a daily affair, isn't unprecedented in history and is certainly well within the rights that we have under international law to operate in the high seas. And it also, you know, to give credit to the administration, at least, they're continuing to keep that kind of presence and demonstration of American naval power in the front yard of the PRC. With the crash of the F-35, again, I spent, you know, a lot of my first part of my career, two-thirds of it, in and around carrier aviation. And so to lose an aircraft is, these things happen when you're operating out in the middle of the ocean. And it's unfortunate. Fortunately, I don't think there were any deaths and the pilot was rescued. And there were some crew members on board that were injured, which is a shame. But I think, you know, we'll have plans in place. We know where the datum is of F-35. And we'll just see if we can get there before the Chinese. The Chinese now have a greatly increased their presence in the South China Sea over the last half a decade or more. And so, you know, when I was in uniform or when I was sailing those waters on the USS Kitty Hawk, the idea that if we had lost an F-18, we wouldn't really have been under such pressure to keep a unit there over the way the crash site is to make sure that somebody didn't come in and steal it. We may have to do that now because of the Chinese naval presence, not only many more ships that they have in their inventory, but also the fact that they have these three major bases down in the Spratlys, Fiery Cross, Subi, and Mischief Reefs, those three reefs which have major naval bases there and big runways that can move in aircraft and, you know, deep submersions, people and equipment on a short order. So that's something that's we're going to have to watch.
Yeah. Again, from the perspective of a seasoned professional in this space, Jim, were the Chinese to get their hands on that aircraft, do you think that this would be a significant technology loss for us, intelligence windfall for them, or do we think that they've actually pretty much hoovered up all the information that they need about the F-35 and would not necessarily go to great lengths to try to beat us to the punch in recovering this aircraft?
Yeah, it was interesting. Yesterday, the PRC foreign minister or spokesman, former ministry spokesman Zhao, said that China has no interest in the aircraft or trying to get it. Which could be true, and it could be exactly what you said, which is to suggest that China's already acquired the F-35 technology through other various means, through cyber espionage and human intelligence and other things of that nature. But I still wouldn't put it past the Chinese to pull off a stunt like that. You recall it was probably within the last 5-6 years that they found an ocean glider that our oceanographic research folks use in the Navy. And they were all over that very quickly. And you saw the reaction last, I think it was September, when the USS Connecticut had an incident. And the Chinese interest in the undersea domain has greatly grown. And so this would be a perfect test of capabilities and a bragging right for them if they were able to scoop this up. So I wouldn't put it against them to try it.
Jim, you still track very closely Chinese military capabilities. In fact, you're one of the great sources on how rapidly they are building those capabilities. In addition to the South China Sea facilities, the Chinese have been spending a lot of time with underwater vessels of various kinds, submarines, submersibles, underwater drones, deep underwater hydrographic research vessels and the like, all of which, of course, have a dual-use purpose, if not primarily a military purpose, right? But do they have the capability, do you think, to get at this fighter aircraft in deep water without our knowing they're doing it, even if we have somebody stationed above it?
I think it would be pretty tough for them to do it without us knowing. Do they have the capability? Well, you know, they've been out with the deep submergence vehicles in the Marianas Trench quite frequently every year for the last 5-6 years, setting some of their own national records and deep submergence and operations like that. So what we don't know, at least not in the public domain, is what do they have in terms of deep submergent vehicles that have the capability to either deploy personnel or to deploy, robotic arms and such that could, take this vessel. But I don't think they could get into the region of the datum, which is where the crash site is, without us being aware of it and being able to at least have a general knowledge that they were doing some kind of operation.
Okay, well, let's keep our eye on that, needless to say, closely. Jim, coming up shortly is the summit meeting between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping of China in Beijing on the margins of the beginning of these, I call them genocide games. What do you expect to come out of those conversations at a moment when it seems as though both the Russians and the Chinese are spoiling for fights in their respective areas? Obviously, the Russians in Ukraine most immediately, presumably. The Chinese perhaps in Taiwan, and you've also been warning about what they're up to vis-a-vis India as well. Is there a new axis of evil, if you will, that's being forged here and that might go very dangerously ugly?
I think, Frank, it's not new. I think for some of us, we've been warning about China-Russia relations. Alliance may be a too strong of a word, but the idea that China and Russia have been sharing military cooperation since 2005 at the establishment of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And now we have 17 years worth of, combined exercises, military exercises between their two militaries, ranging from naval operations in the Sea of Japan, the north of the Yellow Sea, into the Mediterranean, and even into the Baltic. So they've operated in naval terms around the world. A couple of years ago, the Russians held their big strategic nuclear exercise called Zapad, and the only nation that was invited to come and observe were the Chinese, which is kind of unprecedented. to have them have a look inside at Russia's nuclear strategic exercise process. So they're very close. And what I'm frustrated with is folks in D.C. That continue to say, oh, there's nothing really to worry about, and they're really not that close, and we should make more of it than we do. And I think at a minimum, what you have is two large militaries that are going to be cooperating with each other. And that places, our forces in a position of risk, whether or not they both combine to attack us in some way or attack the Ukraine or attack Taiwan. The fact of the matter is they're going to be cooperative with each other. And certainly in terms of sharing intelligence and information, and if not outright, some kind of coordinated activity and timing of the two different theaters.
Which would be very challenging, needless to say, either of them probably, but certainly a combination of those. Yeah, interestingly,
we're not prepared for two major theater war fronts. We left that capability 20 plus years ago.
Yeah. I'm not sure we're so capable of even a single one at the moment. But Jim, speaking of naval exercises, the Russians and the Chinese last week, as I understand it, engaged in some in the North Indian Ocean with the Iranians as well. What are we to make of that? And does that up the ante even further on the dangers that we may be entering a moment where this, for want of a better term, axis of evil is going to have yet another front opening up in the Middle East as well?
Yes, Frank, I think that is a correct term for Russia, China, and Iran, and then we can even throw in North Korea. But in terms of the trilateral naval exercise, I think this is the second time that they've done such a thing, and certainly the one that's, I think, came about in the quickest from the time they announced it to the time they conducted. This is certainly a step up from the previous discussions about doing such a trilateral Navy exercise a year or two ago. And so I think what it says is not only is China and Russia's militaries working together, and not only is China helping to fund Iran, and so is Russia, now you're seeing the Russian or the Iranian military reap some of the benefits of that because of this infusion of this foreign capital, especially from China.
Yeah, well, so and now we South Korea as well, at our instigation, as I understand it. And this is one of those pieces of this puzzle that I think most of us are really missing, is the degree to which it is in the mutual interest of China, Iran, Russia to operate in increasing concert. Jim Fennell, as they all together and individually challenge us, challenge our alliance relations and the so-called international community more generally. It's hard to overstate the impact, it seems to me, of emboldening the mullahs in Iran, for example, or Putin, for example. If the Chinese are now capable of, confronting, challenging, perhaps even defeating the United States. And you have warned recently, I think, Jim, about the possibility that we may simply not be up to conflict with the Chinese in the Western Pacific at this moment. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I have a great concern about our capacity. I mean, right now, as you mentioned at the top of this segment, that we have two carriers, the Carl Vinson and the Abraham Lincoln, operating out in the Far East in the South Pacific. Last week, they were in the Philippine Sea, operating with some of our amphibious carriers and some of the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, which are all good signs. But we were doing that in a way to cover our bases because we had sent the USS Ronald Reagan, which is home ported in Yokosuka, Japan, we had sent it out to the Middle East to cover, last fall's withdrawal from, ignoble withdrawal from Afghanistan. And so we had not sent our carrier that had been forward deployed to Japan since 2003. We had never, in almost 20 years, we had not sent that carrier out to the Middle East because we knew it had a responsibility to provide assurance to our allies that we were covering down in Asia. So we've moved our chess pieces around. And so now we have the Lincoln, the Vinson, and the Reagan all out in the Western Pacific. Reagan has gone back into port here over the last week. And we've kind of left the Middle East open to a degree. And now all of a sudden you see these Chinese, Russians, and Iranians exercising, almost in a devious way to say, ha, 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 America, you can't cover everything, and we're going to pop up and cause you concern and make you run your fleet ragged, like they're doing with Taiwan, with the Taiwan Air Forces. Every time they penetrate the Taiwan Air Defense Identification Zone, they're causing the Taiwan Air Force to respond, and they're just running them into the ground. And, you know, some people, Admiral Blair a couple of years ago told, recommended that Japan and Taiwan not respond every time the Chinese entered the ABIZs of those two countries and selectively respond. And I disagree with that philosophy. I think what we should do is provide more, you know, fighters to Taiwan and more fighters to Japan and more pilots and more fuel and more OPTAR, and let them be able to respond to China's incursions and let them see that they're not going to find a weakness in the wall there. And some people say that's unsustainable and it's, you know, it's not possible with the budgets that we have. Well, then we need to go back and look at our budgets and say, what are we spending our money on? You know, let's not give away $85 billion of military equipment in the Middle East. Let's use some of that in places where we could, where we need it.
Yeah, Jim, this is such a critical point, and I don't know that it's being adequately attended to in the United States at the moment. Worse yet, I fear that one of the takeaways for the Chinese from our participation in these, genocide games, if you will, the Winter Olympics in Beijing next month, and that of others around the world, is going to be further emboldening the Chinese Communist Party to think that it can act with impunity. How do you see that, very quickly, if you would?
Well, I see the genocide games is, I think, a right term for them. We should not allow China to have a propaganda win and think that they can get away with holding these games without the world really having it stuck in their mind, that term. We are holding Olympic Games in a nation that has over 1 million people in prison. And we know that they're organ harvesting. And we know that they've, you know, they're cracking down on people in Hong Kong so they can't even say what they think without fear of being hauled off to jail, shutting down all the newspapers and press organs in Hong Kong, and their threats against Taiwan. So these are the genocide games, and we should be not attending in any way, shape, or form. But the fact of the matter is we're going to have some people there. And so they need to be careful. One, they need to be careful because China's made it clear that if they speak up and say anything, that they could be at risk from who knows what, thrown in jail. They're also going to be at risk because of the weather there. And we're seeing reports of the Chinese weather is not really well because of the pollution, because of the winter weather. And so it'll be interesting to see what the athletes really say about the conditions there, especially since it looks like most of the snow is going to be artificially made, which, yes, that probably happens in other winter Olympic venues. But I think most of the snow for these games are going to be artificial, and that will be something of interest to see how the athletes respond. But again, from a propaganda perspective, we should be pointing out at every time that this is a games that are being held by a genocidal regime, that we do not support them. And to the extent that we can boycott with diplomats, boycott watching television, no American should watch 1 minute of these games. I've been to the Olympic Games. I was at the 92 games in Barcelona. I'm a big fan of the Olympics. But I will not watch 1 minute of these games.
Amen. Jim Fennell, thank you for your service to our country over many years that you are continuing to render these days, among other things, as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China. We appreciate your visits with us. We hope we'll have another one very soon. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Andrei Ilarionov, a Russian expat who used to work for Vladimir Putin. We'll talk with him about Ukraine, what Putin's up to there, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined for the first time by Dr. Andrei Ilarionov. He is a man with extensive experience in senior levels of the Russian government after the Russian Revolution, that is, of the Second Revolution. He served as a chief economist to several prime ministers in also to Vladimir Putin, a man he knows well. He is these days a senior fellow, I'm pleased to say, of the Center for Security Policy, and we're delighted to have a chance to pick his brain to assess and try to make sure we understand what is going on with respect to this crisis in Ukraine and the possibility of a Russian invasion of that country, I should say, another Russian invasion of that country. Andrei, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you very much, Frank, for the invitation. I'm delighted to be with the Center for Security Policy and to work with you and your colleagues.
Thank you. Let me ask you, first of all, to assess the proposition that the crisis at hand is at least in part a product of the Biden presidency rather than Vladimir Putin's ambitions. Some have called this a wag the dog exercise, hearkening back to what Bill Clinton did to try to deflect attention from some of his personal scandals with a crisis in the Balkans. What's your take on how we've gotten to this point in Ukraine, as well as where we are now and Biden's role in all?
Thank you, Frank, for bringing the most important point right from the very beginning. Unlike all previous aggressive imperialistic campaigns that Mr. Putin launched against its neighbors like Georgia, Ukraine, or even remote countries like Syria, this recent crisis that we are facing over the last 3 months seems to me it has been originated or initiated not by Putin, but by American administration, by the current American administration, which is very unusual. And it is not something that many people would expect and would understand in such a way. And this current crisis over the last 3 months is definitely organized by two sides, by the current U.S. administration and by Putin administration, with a clear division of labor, with the so-called good cop and bad cop. The role of good cop went to Mr. Biden, and role of the bad cop went to Mr. Putin. So the American side has launched this campaign on October 30th, 2021, last year, with a publication in the Washington Post. And over the next few days, Washington Post has been joined by Politica, Foreign Policy, CNN, and other U.S. outlets. For some time, no other media, neither from United States or Europe, didn't join this campaign. And that campaign stated that Mr. Putin is accumulating troops on the Ukrainian border with the intention to attack Ukraine again, but not with the small skirmishes, but with outright full-scale invasion, which step by step grew to the outright big war with the purpose, with the claimed purpose, to conquer substantial portion of Ukraine, like left bank of Ukraine, southern Ukraine, with reaching Dnieper River, with crossing Dnieper River, with encirclement of such big Ukrainian cities like Kharkiv, Dnipro, and even capital of Ukraine, Kyiv. And now we can see that many Western medias are publishing maps like Washington Post, like New York Times, like Bild, like some other publication. They're publishing maps showing all these arrows of Russian troops moving in depths of Ukrainian territory and conquering this territory and claiming that it's going to be huge, big war. Mr. Putin looks like decided to support this claim and to help these so-called hypotheses, those claims. And he started, it's fact of life, he started to move some of Russian troops. But those movement of the Russian troops on the so-called Ukrainian border is very far from the size that Russia or anybody else would need to have a full-scale invasion, a new invasion into the Ukrainian territory. All
okay.
military experts.
Let me ask you, if I can, Andrei, this thesis that the need, perceived need, particularly after the Afghan debacle, for Biden to sort of burnish his credentials, resulting in Putin sort of playing his part in all of this, is sort of stunning, I think, on the face of it. But also, does it actually suggest that Putin does not have designs on Ukraine? Are you saying that? Or are you saying that he does, but he's sort of playing a part in this somewhat, well, orchestrated drama with Joe Biden?
This is a very, very important point. We need to understand that Putin does have his idea and his dream to establish control over Ukraine. That is no doubt. And over the last 8 years, he has said many times that his purpose to establish his control over Ukraine. It's doubtless. But at some point, Putin understood that by using strictly military means, or only military means, or first of all military means, he cannot achieve that goal. Ukraine today is not Ukraine of year 2014. Ukrainian army is much, much stronger. The public attitudes towards Putin personally and towards Russia is completely different from what Ukraine had 8 years ago. Today, Ukraine is ready to resist, it's ready to fight, and is going to fight. And actually, the military operations in the east over the last several years have shown that the quality of Ukrainian troops today are at the same level or similar level as the Russian troops, or maybe even a little bit higher in strictly conventional warfare. And Putin knows it very well. So for the purpose to establish military control over Ukraine, Putin needs huge army. These 100,000 troops that have been claimed located on the Ukrainian border is absolutely not enough for any serious operation against Ukraine. In the operation, for example, during the Second World War, for any serious operation on the Ukrainian territory, as you know, just the front moved from the west to east and from the east to west several times during the Second World War. In each of those operations, Soviet army was using Russian troops of size 1.6 million or 2.1 million soldiers and officers. Just to get one city, Kharkiv, which is 50 kilometers from the Russian border, the current Russian border, Soviet army in 1943 was using 700,000 soldiers. To liberate Kyiv, the group was about 1 million. Certainly, it was a Second World War. Today's world is a different one. But we have the experience of Russian-Georgian War. Georgian troops in year 2008 was 27,000 altogether. Putin used against Georgian army his troops of 83,000, which means 3-1. Now Ukrainian army has active duty 250,000 troops. 200,000 are in active reserves. 400,000 are veterans from this war in the east. In all those operations, Ukrainian that are ready to use resistance against Russian troops is about 1 million. These 100,000 Russian troops...
Andrei, I'm going to run out of time here before I run out of things to talk with you about. Let me just ask the essence of the question, I guess, is that if Putin were serious about invading Ukraine, he would have to have a vastly larger army. He has a relatively small one, still substantial, but nonetheless relatively small one, on the borders of Ukraine, including in Belarus now. And you're saying that that means he's not seriously interested in actually invading Ukraine. He's hoping to achieve certain, presumably, political outcomes, geopolitical strategic outcomes in Ukraine, and perhaps vis-a-vis NATO, without actually having to go to war? And is Biden playing into that, do you think, if he has as this ultimate objective really just sort of burnishing his credentials in the foreign policy space rather than, you know, trying to punish, let alone actually defeat Vladimir Putin?
Yes, this is a correct description. The plan that is being played by two sides at the same time, by Putin and Biden, or Biden and Putin, is such. So Biden is creating the impression that it's going to be a big war. Putin is helping him to create and sustain such an impression. And both of them are trying to convince or to threaten Ukrainian administration, Ukrainian government, to implement the so-called Minsk Agreement. If they will be, if they succeed in that business, it means that Ukraine would lose its sovereignty. And it is exactly the purpose of Putin's action. For Biden, it is not so important because he doesn't care about Minsk Agreement and about sovereignty of Ukraine, but he would have Putin on his side in this regard. And Putin and Biden would be portrayed as a person who prevented big war in Europe. And that is why he would pretend on for Nobel Prize as his former partner, Mr. Obama, a few years ago. And definitely, in this regard, his support, political support in the United States would rise, and it would might help him in this upcoming November election this year into Congress. So for Mr. Biden, it looks like it's a, first of all, domestic policy issue, how to get political support within the country.
Things go according to this plan, it might be something of a win-win, I guess you'd say, for the two men. Putin gets, you know, a greater degree of, well, dominion over his neighbor with the acquiescence of the Western nations. Biden is able to claim that he staved off a military conflict in this manner. I have two concerns about it, I have to say, Andre, and that is one, that the history of these things, notably I'm thinking of the Czech betrayal before World War II, is that they can end up badly when you wind up emboldening people who actually are pretty ruthless and malevolent types, and I think Putin is. Secondly, that there may be miscalculations along the trail, that Putin may, in fact, not play the role and decide that this is a unique opportunity, especially if the Chinese wind up, as we were talking about with Captain Jim Fennell in the previous segment, deciding that they're going to go for it in Taiwan, and suddenly it's a game on in terms of territorial ambitions being fulfilled. Your thoughts on those points?
First of all, you're right. This is a very risky game, no doubt. But the difference between today and 1938, between Ukraine and Czechoslovakia, is that Ukrainians are ready to fight. And I talked to many of them. I'm right now in Kyiv, and I do feel this Ukrainians' spirit. They're not going to surrender. They are going to fight. And just, I know a little bit how Ukrainians do fight. It would be not possible. It would be not difficult. It would be not possible for Putin to win militarily. It is impossible right now. It is not yet 2014. Ukraine will not be able to win over Russian troops. It's true. But Ukraine will not surrender.
They can take a huge toll. Yeah. And that brings me to the last question, and that is Russian popular attitudes towards all of this. Is there any perceptible appetite on the part of the Russian people for a military conflict and possibly, as you say, a very bloody one?
Definitely not, but nobody is asking Russian people, and Russian people do not have say in that business. Russia is authoritarian.
But is it weighing on Putin, knowing him as you do? Do you think that this is a consideration for him, that this may prove to be unpopular and perhaps
no.
Precipitate an end to his tenure, his role?
Essentially,
his
no. No.
Not this a factor.
Is an authoritarian regime, and Putin is doing whatever he wants. There is no opposition in Russia. There is no free press. There is no possibility to express disagreement or opposition to Putin's policy. So that is why, as in any authoritarian or totalitarian regime,
this brings me back to my fundamental concern is that he may just decide to do it, seeing the circumstances and the possibilities here of achieving a greater degree of hegemony and power at the expense of NATO, the West, and the United States most especially. Andrei, I hope you'll come back soon. There's a lot more to talk about here, especially I would like to pick your brains about the impact on all of these things of the growing European dependence on Russia for energy, notably with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But that's for another day. Thank you for your time on this occasion and for the chance to visit with you. It's I hope, the first of many such conversations. Thank you, sir. Thank you for what you're doing now with our Center for Security Policy.
Thank you. God bless. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
A pleasure.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a delight to say we are joined by Christine Douglas-Williams, a dear friend and colleague from north of the northern border of the United States in Canada. She is an author. She has been a television and radio personality. She has served formally as a director of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation and on the board of governors of the Gatestone Institute. She writes frequently for wonderful online service of our friend Robert Spencer, Jihad Watch. Among other things, she has written The Challenge of Modernizing Islam. A very thoughtful woman, and we wanted to pick her brains about a thought-provoking development on the northern side of our border, namely the response of tens of thousands of truckers, Canadian and apparently now some American, to some of the things that the Trudeau government has been up to that should be deeply troubling, not just to the people of Canada, but to us as well. Christine Douglas-Williams, it's great to have you back. A happy new year to you, rather belatedly, but it's good to have you with us once again. Welcome.
Happy new year to you, Frank. It's a privilege to be back with you.
With all of this? What are the truckers doing and for what?
Very briefly, of what started this in the first place. First of all, the U.S. and Canada perfectly understand why the trucking industry is very vital to our nations. Everything that you have in your house that you own, from food to appliances, it's being delivered by a truck. So when it's been calculated by Reuters that when you look at the calculation of goods that have been going between Canada and the United States, it runs around approximately $521 billion. That's the figure that was given by that agency. So you're looking at a high number here. So imagine bringing in a vaccine mandate now, Canada, where you have to be vaccinated to enter. Now, it's really interesting that prior to this vaccine mandate that's coming from Trudeau actually tweeted out, and I just saw this yesterday by somebody who sent it to me. He tweeted out that the truckers were considered a vital service, and when you look at these necessary services, they're usually exempt. So all of a sudden, he turns around an essential service, that's the term, and he says, look, you guys have to be vaccinated. So that triggered off people, because one could only imagine not just those that are unvaccinated being turned away, and the Trucking Association says something like 85% are vaccinated, but that leaves 15% that are not. But you're looking at the pandemonium at the border, checking everybody's vaccine passport. If something comes up a little uncertain, they're put to the side, they're carrying perishable goods, and so forth. So this is really triggering off a problem with the supply chain, number one. And number two, what about the livelihoods of these truckers? So it got to the point where Canada, I would say, not just the truckers, this was a trigger, got to the point where they were saying, what's going on? And what I find particularly interesting about what followed was there started to be this unity going on in Canada. And it didn't have all to do with vaxxed versus unvaxxed. It was a freedom movement. We don't like what we see going on. We don't like the fact that the government is telling you what to do. Getting into the efficacy of the vaccine, the statistics, that's another story. But just the mere fact that you're being forced to be vaccinated, otherwise you lose your livelihood or society suffers a supply chain problem because of it, started to trigger a unity, sort of a spirit that went across the country.
Beyond the truckers themselves.
Beyond the truckers, mm-hmm. Yes. And that's where I'm getting straight into what this Freedom Convoy, it was called. And it was started by a group that, it's called Canada Unity Group. Most people, I would say, don't even know this group. But what happened since is that a lot of the freedom groups across the Canada, and you have a lot in the United States too, I'm talking activists for freedom, joined onto this Canada Unity Group. And before you know it, there was this huge convoy being developed. It turned out to tens of thousands that said, look, we've had enough. We're going to go to Ottawa, right from the East Coast to the West Coast of Canada, they joined in this convoy. And then it was announced that 10,000 from the States was on its way, mostly at the Vancouver entrance into Canada. But there's some coming into the East from the East as well. I'm talking Ontario borders. So this is an enormous movement. So reading about it, watching the videos that was coming mostly from Twitter, because at first the mainstream media was pretty much ignoring it. Then they started calling it a fringe group because they were parroting off what Trudeau was calling it. In fact, he was very insulting, calling it a fringe group, calling the unvaxxed all kinds of names like racist, misogynist, which is crazy because when you do a stats on who is wary of this, it's across the board. It didn't matter what race you were. So anyway, people were getting upset by this, and I started to be really interested in this convoy and think, wow, we haven't seen anything like this. You're seeing the horn honking by these truckers. You're seeing flags on these trucks. You're seeing people come out to greet them all over the place. There was a story of the Hutterite community that made sandwiches and soup for them. They weren't allowing the truckers to come in, so they drove out of their communities to give it to them. There was a Sikh community who gave them sandwiches. There were women all over the place and some guys making sandwiches. Just a movement.
And you yourself, I gather, have participated in one of the overpass demonstrations of solidarity with these guys. I gather this has been something that's been taking place even in the pretty inclement conditions in wintertime Canada, right? Yeah. So is this basically civil disobedience, and to what end, beyond the obvious symbolism of it?
That's a very important question. It has a couple layers, but I'll tell you first about my experience. Now, this happened yesterday. I was out running an errand early in the morning. I came back and I had this feeling, wait a minute here, the truckers are passing by. These people are, a lot of them have lost their jobs. They're really into a movement that I support, the freedom. So I figured, okay, I'm going to find one of the overpasses because they're passing between Niagara and Toronto. And then I started reading like crazy. Let me see here if I could find a location where it might have a few people. And I discovered that there was in a nearby city, Burlington, that's about 45 minutes to an hour drive away from Toronto, was no traffic. And there was an overpass, the Guelph Line overpass. And I thought, I'm going to go out just to see what's there. But I decided to bring a flag with me, this huge flag that once flew on Parliament Hill in 2020 on 9/11. I thought, what better opportunity for that flag to be waved again, this huge flag, because you know the size of these official flags. And I brought it with me, hoping to find somebody that might be able to help me lift it. Well, boy, did I find a lot of people. In fact, over 1,000 people, Frank, showed up at that overpass. And some of them were under the overpass, right there lining the highway with their flags. And as this convoy arrived, I mean, we didn't know exactly when they would because they have stop-offs. So people were out there in the cold weather. I mean, on this overpass, open wind, freezing cold, high winds. And I, for one, stood there at least an hour and a half. And many people were there that were older. They stayed, and the flags were waved, and the horns were honked. It was electric, and I went by myself. Before you knew it, four people were helping me raise that flag. The spirit out there was one of genuine love and unity for the country. And what intrigued me was the conversation.
And over this question about mandatory vaccinations, is that what's bringing people together? Or
Yes.
Simply solidarity with the truckers on that issue.
It's about freedom. I was listening to the conversations, and that weighs into your question, Frank. And there were a few liberals that I detected there, and they were saying, we don't have a problem with the vaccine at all, but we have a problem with what Trudeau is doing for freedoms and stirring divisions among Canadians and creating hate against the unvaxxed. That was the spirit that brought people out. Many were anti-Trudeau. Many were against this particular vaccine. They're not anti-vax. But many also received their vaccines, and they were still out there protesting with the unvaxxed. And that was the center core, freedoms. It became beyond the issue. Now, the mainstream media, many of them are still stoking divisions and saying it's about the unvaxxed, but I'm starting to see a difference. A Toronto Star article, for instance, yesterday accurately reported about that event that I attended, and they accurately said it was about 1,000 people, because usually they deflate the numbers when it doesn't suit them, and there was nothing negative being said about these protesters. However, many are stoking fears and saying, well, what happened on January 6th, and you and I know about that situation, Frank, is going to happen here.
Here in Washington.
There has been, right, there has been no reports of any violence whatsoever.
Well, this is impressive, to say the least, and I think heartening, and I suppose this is why you're now getting reports that American truckers are heading that way in the demonstration of solidarity, because I think there are lots of people, as we saw in the march in Washington over the weekend, for example, and in a lot of other places besides, growing resistance to, if not the vaccines themselves in every case, certainly to the idea that you must take them, you must give them to your children, you must, you know, demonstrate, you know, with a passport, an electronic passport of some kind, that you have been jabbed, as they say. This is, you know, I believe tyranny.
And there are two critical questions that we need to address today, Frank, before we even close, because these are the questions on Canadians' minds right now. Where is this ending? What is Trudeau doing? And could this possibly end up violent? Those are the questions. Right now, this is what's going on with Trudeau. Yesterday, conveniently, he went into lockdown. He said he was exposed to someone, nobody knows who that person is, with COVID. But according to what an article pointed out in the National Post, the Ontario Public Health Guidelines say that anyone who does not have symptoms of COVID and tests negative on a test does not need to self-isolate unless the person is of their own household. So he is going over and above what the guidelines are. So it looks like he's running. So he's in hiding. Yes, he's in hiding right now. So the question is, these truckers, what is their end? They're waiting for answers. They're saying, we're not leaving Ottawa. And this is going to be interesting until they lift those trucker mandates. So it's going to be a standoff. And another question that's being asked, because the media is stoking it, we're going to end up with violence the same way we saw in Washington. No. If violence even begins, it won't be that movement. That movement has been working with police, and they've been calling for peace. There's always Antifa or some group that's willing to stir trouble. So we don't know what could start and who could start it. But they're just waiting to attack this freedom movement. And it is definitely, without a doubt, a freedom movement, and has proven to be. But no one can predict who could begin to stir up trouble. So right now, there's a big question mark. What's going to happen once they arrive in Ottawa? It's going to be pandemonium in Ottawa. And when they're going to leave, and how many truckers are going to actually stay on and wait out Justin Trudeau?
What is the ETA in Ottawa? Do you know? It's obviously
Saturday.
It's going to be different.
They say it's Saturday.
They're all syncing
Saturday,
up on Saturday.
Yeah.
Wow.
They believe Saturday at different times, depending on where the convoys are arriving from. It will also intrigue you personally, Frank, to know that our transportation minister in Canada is none other than Omar Al-Ghabra, who has a horrible reputation historically when it comes to issues involving Islamism. He has been written about on Jihad Watch and on many different sites with concerns about where he stands.
Well, we have problems with our own transportation secretary here, Pete Buttigieg, as well. So we're watching that problem exacerbated. Just very quickly, Christine, obviously, as you mentioned in your opening comment, trucks are an indispensable part of the supply chains for our societies on both sides of the border. And the obviously vitally important commerce between our two countries. It will presumably be in very short order, if it's not already the case, that people going up and perhaps parking for some time in Ottawa is going to be a very disruptive on both societies, not just on the government. Now, presumably that will apply some pressure to the governments in question, but what are people in Canada saying about that? Are they in solidarity, notwithstanding the possibility that it may be inconveniencing them or possibly even entail some real hardships?
Canada is in a position of division right now. There are those who are not standing with the truckers, in fact, blaming them for some of the shortages that we're already seeing on the shelves because the supply chain has already been backed up, which is too bad. But people who are advocating for freedoms and understand that this is a much larger issue than the vaccine here, they're the ones that are standing up and saying, look, yes, there's a disruption, but the disruption has been going on for some time. The threat that we're seeing to our freedoms is much greater than the inconvenience. But there are definitely those within the media, the mainstream, not all, and there are those within society that are pointing fingers at the truckers and trying to create division. But their real goal, of course, is to shut down and break the will of the truckers because they're realizing that these people are representatives now and they're deemed heroes of Canada's freedom.
Yeah. This is so important. Christine, thank you for this important report, and I hope that we will continue to get insights and updates from you, perhaps at Jihad Watch, perhaps elsewhere, but also here at Secure Freedom Radio. Come back to us again soon if you would. In the meantime,
thank you
for this great contribution, and I hope you'll stay well. I hope
the rest of you will be well as well.
Thank you, and that you'll come back to us again, same time, same station on Monday. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Winston Churchill described World War II as the unnecessary war. He believed rightly that the West's failure to understand and counter early on the territorial and other hegemonic ambitions of its totalitarian foes made an otherwise avoidable conflict inevitable. That failure was made palpable in the British and French governments' negotiations with Adolf Hitler behind the backs of their Czech allies. The resulting agreement produced not peace in that time, but the loss of a free world nation and set in motion Axis aggression in Europe and elsewhere. The bilateral and NATO diplomacy now underway with Russia's Putin, excluding the Ukrainians, is signaling again the West's irresolution and weakness. Tragically, as in 1938, the world seems likely soon to reap the whirlwind, not only in Eastern Europe, but in Asia and the Middle East in the next horrific and unnecessary global war. This is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.